thank you all for being here. One of the cool things about the job I have now is that I get to spend a lot of time with our Reserve Bank presidents, and they bring an incredible range of expertise to the table in their communities. And as I think you're going to hear, each of their communities are pretty different, even within their Reserve Bank. So let me just start. I'll start with Tom, and we'll go this way. Can you just describe for us, you know, what are some of the rural communities like in your district?
So 5th District is West Virginia, Maryland, D.C., North and South Carolina, and Virginia. There's rural communities everywhere, but I sort of think of them as two big archetypes. We have a large part of Appalachia, and so you know what that looks and feels like and what the issues are. But we also have the I-95 corridor, and the I-95 corridor, unlike Appalachia, is majority-minority. Unlike Appalachia, it's blue, not red. But those communities have the same sets of workforce, healthcare, education issues that you have in both places. So we really enjoy the chance to be present in both types of communities.
Cool. Anna? All right. So I'm representing Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Feds. So we're talking about the eastern two-thirds of Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey. So let me start with New Jersey, which you don't traditionally think of as a rural state. And indeed, by like Census Bureau definitions, there are no rural counties in New Jersey. But in my travels to southern New Jersey, there are places that are distinctly rural mm-hmm. in how they work. You know, they meet some of the same characteristics as those that, you know, that Michael and Tom have both been talking about. And, you know, New Jersey is not called the Garden State for nothing. You know, it's the second largest producer of blueberries in the country, the third largest of cranberries, and, you know, I can go on and on. But, right, you know, so there are rural communities everywhere, although, of course, it's a little different if you're in a rural community that's 90 minutes from New York City mm-hmm. than if you're someplace in the far western corners of Pennsylvania. Delaware, another place where the southern part of the state is pretty rural. It has some advantages of having the opportunities to develop tourism as one of its local industries, but it's also a place where the entire state chickens outnumber people 200-1. So the chicken industry is vitally important to that community and has been affected by some of the factors that you were talking about. You know, a lot of the chickens are exported, and a lot of the equipment that you use to raise chickens is imported, for example. And then Pennsylvania, you know, there the rural communities are maybe more like what you picture as a rural community. Indeed, when there was the picture up here of the kind of, you know, small town Main Street, that looks like some of the places in the district that I've visited over, you know, since I started in July. And there you see a lot of the, you see really committed residents. Indeed, every rural place that I visited in the district I've met somebody who grew up there, mm-hmm. left, went to school, did some other things, and then came back because they wanted to raise their family in a community like the one that they grew up in, and they wanted to, you know, make that community what they needed for their family. And I think that part is something that's really, it's a little bit of an intangible, but it's really important. So places where people are, you know, I think in Pennsylvania, a distinctive feature of rural communities is that manufacturing is really important. So of rural jobs, something like 23% of those jobs in Pennsylvania are in manufacturing. And so, you know, you think of agriculture, but a lot of rural jobs are manufacturing, healthcare, retail, and that's particularly true in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So I'll stop there. There's a little flavor of all the range of rural communities.
That's great. Susan, do you want to describe
Great.
Your communities?
Sure. And first, just really delighted to be here with all of you. There's so many really important topics to discuss, and there's just a lot of expertise throughout this room, so a real pleasure. So the first district, which is the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston's district, is most of New England, and you know, all of New England except Fairfield County and Connecticut, basically, so five different states. And there's a theme here, which is that while there's some things that apply more broadly, there are also some real differences. And let me say a little bit more about that. But I also thought that, you know, it might be, as I thought about which of the many things to say, there are a number of misconceptions about rural communities mm-hmm. that, it, you know, I thought it would be helpful to mention. You know, one is the idea of agriculture being the economic driver, which is really, while there's certainly some communities, that, but certainly in aggregate, that is not the general story. In fact, the industrial mix and the share of employment is actually similar in rural areas nationally to urban areas, and that's also true in New England. And so, you know, in New England, for example, over 20% of people are employed in education and healthcare services, and over 15% in professional and business services. And so the diversity of the kinds of things people are doing is really important. And I think a theme there is that sometimes or often the aggregates actually mask big differences between what's happening in individual communities. And you heard about that from Anna and from Tom as well. So about 12% of the overall population in New England lives in rural communities. Unlike the national context where that's been declining, it's been overall relatively stable for the past 50 years in New England. And in Massachusetts, it's, you know, more like 2%. But then in Vermont, it's more like 60% of the population. So those are huge differences in terms of the different communities. And just to end with just a couple of examples. So while natural resources is overall a relatively small share of employment, there are coastal communities in Maine where it might, even the direct employment is over 20% in fisheries in those areas. And if you do the indirects, it's even larger than that. And then if you go to White River Junction, which is close proximity to Dartmouth, you have a lot of engineering services, which is what's driving communities, the rural communities in that county, in that area. So the diversity I would highlight as well, absolutely challenges, but also a lot of dynamism and a lot of innovation and a lot of kind of connectivity and culture. So lots to discuss.
Yeah, that's great, Susan. And one of the things I really love about the panel we have here today, these three presidents, is they may not be the first three presidents that everybody thinks of as having communities that are in rural America, but they, for sure, you've just heard, are. There are rural communities all over the United States. And I think, you know, the kind of attention that these three presidents are paying to issues in rural America is really just fantastic. I'm going to go the other way down the line, Susan, and ask you to maybe bring to the fore some of the, you know, challenges and opportunities that you see in your community. I know that, as each of you have discussed and I mentioned, there's broad diversity in kinds of communities in rural America, but maybe you could give us some examples of challenges and opportunities in your district.
Sure, let me start with challenges, but I also want to highlight some of the opportunities and real inspiring examples of that. Some of the challenges that I hear a lot about are the same ubiquitous challenges that I hear from all of the communities across my district. Housing really tops the list, and I think a lot of people may not really recognize that in a lot of rural communities, some of the housing challenges, affordability, availability, might be even more acute. So, you know, during the pandemic, there were a lot of people who recognized the beauty of rural areas in New England, and it actually exacerbated some of the housing challenges in terms of available housing stock. And so housing is really one of the key ones. There are other kinds of barriers to participation as well. Childcare challenges are quite significant in a number of different places. And also, you know, some of the challenges related to youth migration, and that's a theme that I hear about in aging. And then there are a lot of physical challenges as well. It's not just broadband, also cell service, healthcare access, infrastructure, so a variety of different types of things like that. I would say, and I mentioned dynamism and innovation, that connectivity and problem-solving dynamic, which is just palpable in so many communities, is really key. And just to mention maybe two examples. So Washington County in Maine, up in northern Maine, it's actually called the Sunrise County because it's the easternmost part of the U.S., and in that county, members of the county, together with leaders in the Passamaquoddy tribe, came together to really try to address challenges for living wage careers for young people, both because people were migrating back, but also to help people stay and to create vibrancy. And then a very different example in New England as well, in Maine as well, that challenges related to healthcare, the Jackson Labs creating a cancer genomic initiative, which essentially connects global experts in cancer virtually to healthcare community networks in rural areas across the state that would not otherwise have access to the kind of expertise to address those kinds of health challenges. And they're exploring ways to expand that. So a lot of innovation as well. And that really speaks to people together, coming together, and to the collaborations that it really can take to address some of those challenges effectively.
That's great. Quite a diverse range of challenges and opportunities.
So you're probably going to hear some similar themes here, but our team has been doing some focus groups with young people across the district, including in rural areas. And folks in the focus groups that we did in rural areas, younger people, you know, are more likely to leave, you know, where they're living now than compared to this, you know, same people in urban areas, right? And a lot of that is looking at, you know, well, where are the opportunities for me to, you know, get a job, grow a career, things like that. The other thing that comes up in those conversations is access to transportation. Mm-hmm. It can be pretty challenging to live in a rural area, particularly if you don't have access to a car or if you got to pay high prices for gas, all of those things. And so those are two things that are big challenges that are just of the people who are there. And then, of course, we all know about the demographic challenges, right? These are tend to be places where the population is older, and that, I think, intersects with some of these challenges. So when I was in Honesdale, which is the northern part of Pennsylvania, this is a community where some people came during the pandemic and set up shop, and so there's been some renovation of properties. There's also an older community that really wants to age in place, right? So they have homes, but those homes, you know, some of them, if you, you know, went and set out the inspector, somebody might say, I'm not going to give you a certificate of occupancy, right? Does the heat work? You know, does the roof need fixing, right? So this isn't so much how do I build new housing stock, but how do I care for and repair the housing stock that we have so that individuals in those communities can live, you know, in the ways that they want. Mm. And those are pretty, you know, challenging, right? Like that's kind of, you know, house by house, how do you solve that problem? And then I'll come back to this sort of like resilience and then the opportunity to look at things holistically. In one community, and I've only been on the job since July, so so some of these are all blurring together here. But there's a community where there was a hospital shutdown, right? Like that's just awful for a rural community, right? These are jobs, this is access to healthcare, this is, you know, so many things that pull a community together. And so folks got together to try to address this problem. And one of the innovative things that came out of those conversations was looking at it not just as like, how do we get a hospital here, but how do we think about this as both a healthcare access and a workforce development challenge so that you can, you know, you can tap into more funds, you get more people at the table. You think about how that hospital plays a role, not just in your health ecosystem, but in your broader economic ecosystem. And that allowed them to bring back, you know, a healthcare facility. And so that opportunity to connect and to think holistically about issues was really important for solutions. And I think that's an opportunity in a lot of different places.
That's great. Tom.
So we have a dual mandate, stable prices, maximum employment. When I started on the job, I talked to my team. I said, okay, where in our district are we winning and losing on maximum employment? And they defined it as employment to population, prime age. So what percent of prime age people are in the workforce? And it turns out that the small towns in our district are 10 points lower than the district as a whole. And they're lower than the cities, and that includes the inner cities, which you sort of normally would have thought would have been the most challenged area. And that's what got me and us started on this journey of really focusing on and digging into the rural markets, because the challenge is getting people to work. And of course, and Susan and Anna have talked about all the issues, there's a set of preparedness issues, if I could put it that way, you know, education, health outcomes, access to institutions like hospitals and banks that not only provide, you know, stable platforms, but also role models of what it's like to be in the workforce and to survive. And then, of course, there's access to work. Whether that be transportation or childcare or housing and all those sorts of things. So those are the challenges, and I think we've all talked about them. I'll say on the opportunity side, we did a piece of research last year. The story out there is that small towns are shrinking. Kids are leaving, populations are shrinking. That's been true for the last 30 years, but that's not true for the last five. And if you look at the last 5 years, not every small town is growing, but a third of them in my district are. And that's a real number. A third of the folks who were shrinking in the 10 years before the pandemic are growing now. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Obviously, remote work is relevant to it. Ex-urban growth is part of it, especially Susan mentioned housing. You know, if you can't afford a house close, you might go move to a place where you only have to go to the office twice a week or whatever, and you might make the hour and a quarter commute. And we're seeing, 360 around Raleigh, 360 around Charlotte, 360 around Greenville, 360 around Columbia, 45 minutes, an hour, hour and a quarter away, places that are still very much small town rural places that are building housing and attracting people. And so I think there's just a story out there of growth that I think is enabled by the fact that you can work some or all of your time remotely. Mm-hmm. Your spouse can work some or more of his time remotely. However that works out, I think that's a real opportunity for these places that have struggled to grow over the last decades.
That's neat. Yeah, I mean, again, it highlights just how different, even in one community, you can have a town that's growing and a town that's shrinking, and trying to figure out what the secret sauce is for that town that's growing is going to be really important. Let me come down the line this way, and again, start with Tom. So we're hearing lots of things you've learned in your districts, but I know that when I travel around the country, and I'm sure when you travel around your districts, you often find kind of a lesson, an aha moment about something that you didn't understand as deeply until you see it in action on the ground, or a challenge that you don't understand as deeply until you experience it in your local community. So this may be a hard question, but when you have traveled around your district, what do you think the lessons are that you've taken away, some of the experiences that you've had that help you better understand the economic circumstances in rural America?
I mean, I'll just talk about what it feels like to sit in a small town with a bunch of small business owners and talk about the economy, because that's mm-hmm. what we do every day. At the FOMC, we worry that the labor market's kind of fragile. Job growth has been relatively slow. People aren't hiring. In the small towns that I'm in, people still can't find workers. Mm-hmm. It's a very tight job market. Mm-hmm. And that relates to the workforce challenges I mm-hmm. talked about before. We talk a lot about some of the issues of the day. Tariffs would be a good example. And you're just struck by the degree of flexibility that bigger companies mm. and bigger communities have to handle these issues versus what small business owners have. You can't go charter a plane during COVID and to get your stuff or to go to China and get stuff in advance. You just can't do that stuff in a small town. So some of the stuff that's out there from a policy standpoint that affects the economy affects these small towns even more. There's a set of initiatives out there that look like they ought to have a ton of impact, but when you get to the ground, you find mm-hmm. out what the challenges are. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded some of the Build Back Better era grants required matching funds, mm-hmm. and we'd be in small towns. They're like, we don't have any matching funds. Like we don't have any. But how do you get it? And so I just think. The stuff that you think is happening on a national scale when translated to a small town local is just not as simple as it looks. That would be my net on it.
So I'm thinking about sitting in some of those same rooms. And mm-hmm. I think also, though, for me, it's also really important just to see things. Mm-hmm. So I think my image of what rural America looks like was kind of crystallized from like visiting my grandparents in western Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting to me to be in the rural parts of Pennsylvania, where the Amish and Mennonite communities are really, really a big part of the population, and to see pretty intense farming activities, right, that are much more concentrated than, like, you know, a big, huge field, and every mile or so there's a farmhouse, and then, you know, there's a church. You know, it's so I think it's a much more dense version of urban living that I had in my head. So that's been eye-opening and important for me, I think, to understand, like, well, wait, not everything is exactly the same, right? Like, just to remind myself of that. I think the other thing that I've learned both from conversations with my team and then from being out there and talking to folks who are thinking about, like, well, how do we make this place a vibrant, you know, a vibrant small town or rural area to raise our kids, to attract business, is that because of some of these issues that Tom's talking about, you really need homegrown conversations, right? Mm. So you need to hear from people, what is our capacity to absorb, you know, whether it's federal or state or philanthropic dollars, like at what pace? Often federal and state legislation and dollars come with like deadlines by when you have to spend things. And I think those deadlines can mean, you know, everybody's got to get the electricians on the same schedule. Well, that's going to be harder if you're in a rural community and there are fewer electricians to start with, right? Or it takes you longer to kind of get the project off the ground and get the pipeline going because you don't have that kind of that same infrastructure. So I think that, you know, one of the things that we try to do in our work is to listen and respond and to have community-led initiatives. And I think bringing people to the table and letting them drive and really inform this process is just absolutely critical in rural areas in particular.
So, and you know, a lot of very similar themes, not surprisingly. And I will reiterate, as my colleagues have, just how valuable and important it is to spend time listening, talking to people, mm-hmm. hearing their experiences, their challenges. I would say one of the things that was really inspiring for me was seeing the local connections solve problems, mm. that when people came together and were focusing on the same problem, how much more effective that was. And, you know, can talk more about some of those kinds of, because a lot of the challenges are real. So the extent to which there are programs that are designed, they're intended to help small business, but a lot of the entrepreneurs in rural areas and in other areas as well are really more micro businesses, mm-hmm. and those programs weren't designed to help micro businesses, and the amount of paperwork and collaboration, if you have a part-time administrator and again you need those matching mm-hmm. funds, it's almost a non-starter, mm-hmm. and so you know, there are areas where some of these programs are just totally underutilized because mm-hmm. they don't match what the needs
reality
and the challenges are.
Mm-hmm.
And people come up with very creative solutions for how to come together to try to figure out how to make things work. But that suggests that there are some collaborative solutions mm-hmm. that could make things easier in that way. So those are some of the things. The infrastructure challenges, I would say, mm-hmm. which we know about, but there's some that we might take for granted that you really can't, like mm-hmm. the cell service one I had mentioned before. So that's kind of a big deal. So, those are some of the things, mm-hmm. and some of them, it's maybe the extent to which there's a disconnect, which is why actually going and talking to people and why empowering people locally. Sometimes just having one person who can dedicate full time to figuring out how to work on something mm-hmm. is a significant kind of enabler mm-hmm. for moving forward with the project. And that's a relatively small fix, mm-hmm. but it's the kind of thing that can actually make a big difference.
We're going to come back to that in a little bit, because I think the convening role that you have all played in your districts is really super important. Let me hone in maybe on one or two challenges that you've talked about, and let's start with access to capital. Susan, you mentioned this, quite extensively. How are communities in your district, rural communities in your district, dealing with what historically has been difficulty getting access to capital, whether that's for agricultural purposes or for home ownership, certainly for entrepreneurial activities and small business formation, or even kind of public infrastructure, which sometimes doesn't have enough access to capital from the public sector. So, again, start with Susan and go down the line. How are you seeing your communities deal with, grapple with issues around access to capital?
Yeah, and the capital access issues are really formative because, you know, that is really central to being able to address some of the challenges mm-hmm. and to really foster vibrancy. Yeah. So just to highlight, because I do want to give a couple of examples mm-hmm. of things that have moved forward, mm-hmm. But what they were able to address, I think, is maybe important to highlight. Mm-hmm. So some, you know, and we actually brought a group together not too long ago, specifically a group of stakeholders from rural areas across New England, specifically to talk about access to capital and what they were seeing and what they were thinking. And the challenges they identified, there were really kind of two buckets. One was more kind of physical, things like infrastructure, you know, not just broadband, but things like water and sewer constraints in terms of abilities to move things forward. But then a variety of other things that are more capacity and some of the things that we were talking about earlier. So one example was a group that came together in Vermont. There was a large project that they were trying to move forward. Mm-hmm. And by bringing together businesses, local civic leaders, you know, community banks. And one of the other pluses that I meant to mention earlier is the just number of times that I have heard about the really strong connections between local and regional community banks in local communities as being very kind of central to providing access to capital and finance and helping to solve some of those challenges. But anyway, this group came together. They had to put together more than a dozen different funding sources to be able to pull together enough to create the capital stack to make this project work. And if you think about all of the pieces that it took to put that together, it gives a sense of kind of the coordination problem. Mm-hmm. But by bringing different leaders together from different sectors, they were able to solve that. Yeah. And so a way to simplify what's needed in order to pull the resources together and jump through the requisite hoops. But I would say the solutions are very collaborative and people thinking together across sectors about identifying the problems and how to work through to solve them.
That's great. Anna?
So I'm gonna focus on community banks as well. Mm-hmm. I think they play a critical role in every one of those conversations where you're sitting around talking with people in rural areas. You can see that ecosystem, right? You can see the connection between, you know, the community bank leader is somebody who lives in that community mm-hmm. and wants that community to thrive and also knows a lot of the people there. Mm-hmm. And so you see the real kind of relationship blending that can overcome some of the more formal barriers to getting access to credit. But I think what we've also seen is that, you know, in surveys, folks in rural communities prefer banking in person and they have stronger preferences to do that than in the urban areas, you know, despite the fact that community banks are shutting. And so we're seeing more banking deserts. I mean, that's one of the things that we've been studying is the existence of banking deserts where there's, you know, you have to go a really, really long way to actually physically get to a branch. So individuals prefer to bank in person. Small businesses really prefer to bank in person, particularly in rural areas. And rural banks are sometimes under threat. And they're a critical part of this ecosystem that helps deploy capital. And part of that is, I think, because they do know the areas and their challenges so intimately. And so, you know, I was in Bird in the Hand, Pennsylvania, where...
Is that actually the name of the town?
It is actually the name of the town. And there's actually Bird in the Hand Bank, which is this fabulous bank, right, that has been... you know, so it's a de novo bank since the financial crisis. I think it's the only one in Pennsylvania. And they serve the Amish community, right? The Amish and Mennonite community. So the Amish and Mennonite community realized that they needed to have a bank, and they wanted to have a bank that would respect the needs of their community, but also work with them. They have, you know, very successful farms, very successful businesses. They have all the banking needs of, you know, any small business or any family. And they also self-insure, right? And so when you're like doing a home mortgage and somebody's like, oh yeah, my community's got that. Right. That's my insurance. Like our banking regulations don't, you know, don't tee up with that. So there's a big effort that it takes to kind of overcome those challenges and allow you know, them to make small business loans, to make home home loans to this community that, you know, makes this possible. And also to kind of respect people's preferences for, you know, not driving and taking the mobile bank out to the place where people are so they can do their banking business at the same time they're gathering to, you know, to sell products or to, you know, to have a have some other kind of gathering. But all of those things, you know, seem really straightforward somehow conceptually, but there's a lot of hoops to jump through to make that happen. So if you go to that, you know, agricultural fair 1 year, it's like you've opened a branch. And if you don't want to go back the next year, you got to talk to the FDIC about like closing that branch the same way you would if you were like closing a physical branch. So there's, you know, so you really have to be committed to the community in order to kind of make these solutions. It takes a lot of kind of commitment and kind of, you know, working the problem from a lot of different sides. So I think that there's the ingenuity there, and then there's the kind of things that, you know, may not seem like that big of a speed bump, but for some places and some communities can be a big speed bump. And so you need people who really understand, like, okay, how do we chip away at that? How do we make that barrier go away?
Tom?
So I think there are issues with access to capital. There are issues on the giving side and issues on the receiving side. We talked about banks on the giving side. If a bank's not in a community, then they're not going to be able to connect to the opportunities. I talk to a lot of philanthropies. They're actually dying to put more money into rural communities, but it's hard to get any scale. It's hard to find, by definition, they're small investments. It's easy. You can find a big investment in whatever, Detroit, and you get a lot of leverage, and you know you have to combine that with 100 small investments. It just doesn't. So there's just not a premise or a proposition. States or even the national government, people still want to give money to small towns, but it's the same thing. If you're trying to do a new water system, would you rather do it in Richmond, where the water system was out a year ago, or would you rather do it in some small town in Virginia? Because the cost is still going to be big and the population served, it's just not as productive. And so, you know, the givers have issues finding premises that work in small towns. And as I was suggesting earlier, the receivers also have issues. Grant writing is a real skill. And, you know, the joke you hear in some states is that all of the grants that go into the community go to the universities because the universities are really good at grant writing. You know, I talked about, you know, matching funds, but a lot of these grant, government grants come with a lot of record keeping, accountability, and other reporting. That's a real challenge in a small town. And the person who comes up with the idea in the small town, almost by definition, it's the first thing they've done, right? And so you've got lots of entrepreneurs who are really excited about things, but they're just not yet ready to position it as well as they could to get access to the funding that's out there. So real challenges on the giving side, on the receiving side.
You know, just picking up on that theme, Tom, and, you know, you mentioned this at the very end, capital alone is not enough. It's never enough. And you also need to make sure that the institution, the small business, the entrepreneur has the capacity, the skills capacity, to use it effectively. And they also need access to business opportunities. If you're in a, you know, in an urban, densely populated urban area and you've got connections to local people, it may be easier for you to grow your business if you're in a rural community or you're in a distressed community in a rural community. It may be much harder to build that kind of network that's required to be to run a successful business. So let me just say, I have got maybe two or three more questions I'm going to ask our panel, and I haven't prepared them for this, but I'm thinking we might open it up to the audience because we've got really terrific experts around us on rural America. And so I'm going to maybe turn to you and see if you either have questions or you have things you want to make sure that we know about that is happening around the country. I don't mean like an advertisement for your work. I mean, you know, stuff on the ground in your communities that you think we should be aware of. So let me ask a question about artificial intelligence, again, that I haven't told them I'm going to ask them. There's a lot of growth in some rural areas in data centers. Have you, in your travels or in your discussions, talked to communities that are grappling with how to manage this data center investment? And I'll be happy to take anybody who wants to start.
I was in Loudoun County, Virginia, which you could argue as a small town, or you could argue as a very upscale, you know, town. And I did a, you know, speech on the economy, and I asked for questions, and the first three were about pocket nuclear reactors. And I didn't understand it because I know nothing about pocket nuclear reactors. But it turns out that the number one issue in Loudoun County was, how are these things, how are we going to avoid these things corrupting the feel of our community? And so they weren't as excited about the tax base. They've got a tax base, but they're really exercised about power wires and electrical, you know, displacement and all of those sorts of things. And that's what you hear. It's a, it's an investment that's not a, a big job creator other than the construction. And, you know, the community leaders like it because there's a tax base that comes with it. But, you know, I think a lot of the communities that I'm in, they don't quite get the value.
I don't know, Susan or Anna, if you want to add anything.
So I've heard varying things about this, right? I mean, this is particularly about data centers as an opportunity for community development. And, you know, I think it varies a lot depending on, you know, whether you're an electricity, you know, exporting state, for example, or one that imports electricity. But one example is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which I think is really interesting, where there was an existing empty warehouse that is going to be a data center. And it's the kind that, I'm gonna totally butcher all of the terminology here, but it's the kind that has like a closed water system. So they're not using new water. It's they're recycling the water through to cool the plates and do all the things that they need to do. So this is not the most, you know, this isn't like one of the really, really, really huge data center farms. It's a relatively contained one. But they've negotiated a community benefits agreement with the community. They expect there to be, you know, 350 ongoing jobs, which is not insignificant there. And it's using existing, you know, space that was empty. When I talk to folks there, there's palpable excitement. And there's also, if we tried to do that deal today, it would never work, even with the community benefits agreement, because there's such a shift in people's attitudes about data centers, you know, partly about, you know, you know, who knows what it is exactly, but they described it as being partly about, like, look, I don't have any other way to express my feelings about or my fears about AI. Therefore, I want to push back on the data center because I know that's part of the ecosystem, right? Even if it might have benefits for my community. So a really interesting and nuanced conversation there. But that is, you know, part of the rural development, you know, story in you know, big parts of Pennsylvania is trying to attract data centers, and there you run right into all these other issues that we've been talking about, like where do you get the electricians? And when you talk to big data center builders, they're like, we're going to go do that in Texas, right? Like, we're going to go do that someplace where we can amass, you know, the energy, the workers, the, you know, like, they're going to look for the, you know, lowest, the easiest place to do stuff. And so the costs are going to be a little higher, I think, in some rural areas. And then the public perception and the public support of these things are that's a moving target.
So I would just say quickly, you know, some similar conversations. You know, there, think about old mill towns that are in areas where there is real, you know, potential with water, but real challenges as well. What seem like small amounts of employment can be notable in small communities, but at the same time, the number of different groups that need to be brought together to really explore how one might take advantage of such an opportunity in a way that actually was consistent with other concerns. I mean, so that can feel daunting, and so I've had conversations with groups that are interested in how do you explore that? How do you learn from what's going well, what isn't, and I would expect that that would expand. But just very quickly, there's a lot of usage of AI in many rural areas that, you know, I hadn't necessarily expected. You know, a lumber mill that you go for a tour and they're using AI to sort planks as a way, not because they were concerned, you know, because they were trying to reduce their labor costs, but because they couldn't hire expertise. And so they felt pushed to figure out a way to meet the demand that they had that was still very strong. And it totally revolutionized how they thought about a lot of the other things and enabled them to employ different kinds of people that they might have better access to. So they're also really interesting examples of how AI is being used in rural industry that, you know, so I I was asked, and I never know, and have heard some very interesting examples of that.
That's great. We've heard lots of what's going on in communities around the country, and Federal Reserve banks play an important role in engaging with their local community and providing research and convening. Maybe we'll do a last round starting with Susan before we open it up, and just you could provide some examples of the way that your Reserve Bank has been engaging with rural areas.
Sure, happy to do that. So we really think of kind of three interlocking sets of roles that we have in that space. One of them is related to research and data, and that is everything from understanding workforce barriers mm-hmm. to understanding household, financial well-being, and to access to capital. Mm-hmm. And it's actually came out of some research that our bank had done some time ago that the kind of foundations of what we call the Working Communities Challenge, or WCC, was really launched. So that research can be the basis for thinking through what kinds of activities might actually help to add vibrancy. Mm. So that's one bucket. A second bucket is really much more related to convenings, to listening, to better understanding. That's something we all do in a variety of different ways. It's kind of two-way communication. But by bringing people together, because so many of the ways to address challenges require people getting interconnected, and the Fed is actually well positioned to do a lot of that work in a variety of different ways. And then the third is more finding ways through programming, through outreach, to actually elevate the insights that you learn from those interactions. And the Working Places Challenge that I mentioned before, I think, is a really example that we're still learning from and finding ways to expand. It ultimately had 30 sites across New England in five different states, and 14 of them were rural sites. Mm. It basically empowered, with a little bit of funding that came from philanthropy and local government sources, to support identifying a single focus area and then developing strategies with local leadership to find ways to address them. Things like workforce development, childcare challenges, access to housing. And again, 14 of those sites were in rural areas across New England. And really, again, came out of the research, engaged through local convenings, but was collaborative programming that we think we can still learn from. And we're always eager to learn from what others are doing as well, and to share the challenges, the opportunities, but hopefully identifying more of the ways to address them.
That's great. Thank you. Anna?
So I'm going to echo a lot of those themes. I think, the research, the convening, the collaboration, are critical components of what we do as well. Often we work in partnership as well to do programming together, right, so that we, can expand our reach and then also, match expertise with the issues. So in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, we're about a day's drive from anywhere in the district. And so one of the things that we do that Philip does a lot of is, puts a lot of miles on and is meeting with stakeholders individually, learning what the issues are, and then being very responsive about putting together webinars that exactly, match, hear the questions, hear the issues that are coming up in his conversations with rural community development leaders and other stakeholders. There's going to be one on data centers, very soon, partly because that's been coming up in those conversations. So those are very kind of like rapid response. You deal with the fact that, everybody's all over the place, but you can put, you've identified a need and you're meeting that need in a really direct way. And that's complemented by gatherings that we do where we bring rural leaders together so that people can network and learn from one another. We also do some more intensive work. And I would say the thing that pulls all of these things together is this idea of kind of like wanting to meet people where they are and help them tell us what they would like to do, and then using our convening power to help them like get together with the expertise that they need, or with the pulling all the stakeholders in a community into the same place. And so that's the Reinventing Our Communities work, which has been a successful model in both urban and rural areas. But you're gathering together all the stakeholders, facilitating a conversation for them to identify the problem that they want to solve, what their priorities are, and then supporting them as they go through that process. And that's helped people to find these holistic solutions that match, you know, healthcare and workforce and say, oh, we can get more money if we approach these two things for together and kind of kill two birds with one stone. But it's a way of building scale, which you heard from Tom is really critical in rural communities and feeding off of like the expertise that does exist. And so those have been really successful models.
Great.
Richmond Bank's working in four areas. The first is just presence. Our outreach team is very focused on making sure you're learning from urban and learning from rural. We even have in their metrics, making sure that they're spending enough time in small towns and not just in big cities. I personally have a plan. I'm 2 days every month in small towns in the district. This week I'm in Brevard, Tryon, Fletcher, and Hendersonville, North Carolina. And every month we're set up, and it's formal, it's structured, it's just part of what we do. So presence is a big part. I think it matters. Second thing we do is trying to lift up what works. Governor Barr was nice enough to mention our annual rural conference. I think this is now the 7th. It'll be in Asheville in October. Those of you who are here and might be interested in coming, Daniel Davis is right there and can get you an invitation. And we're very focused on making sure we expose communities to what other communities are doing that's working, because we don't have all the answers, and many of them do. When we go to a community and something interesting is going on, whether it be the transportation work that's being done in Wilson, North Carolina, or the childcare work that's being done in Abington, Virginia, or the entrepreneurship work that's being done in Grafton, West Virginia, or some of the apprenticeship programs in Yadkin County, North Carolina, we're trying to write about those, publish them, put them on the website, connect them to people so they see things that work and they can, you know, learn from each other and connect to each other. Third thing we do, like Susan and Anna said, is research. I talked about the communities that grow research a little while ago, but I'd also point you to some recent stuff we're doing in community colleges. We're a huge anchor institution in many small towns, highly valuable, massively mismeasured in terms of their impact. That has implications for funding, and we're doing a lot of work on the real impact of community colleges and what works and doesn't work, and how to invest more in those. And so research, that's the third thing. And then, the fourth thing, we were really excited about the Working Cities work that Susan and the Boston Fed have done. And we asked ourselves, can we take some version of that into rural markets and do a highly focused rural version of Working Cities called the Rural Investment Collaborative? And we're now in our third cohort, call it 60, 70 individual entrepreneurs in small towns throughout our district who have gone through framer training, and have gotten seed grants to help proposals for their work. And we're trying to do our best to introduce them to funders who can help fund it more broadly. So, you know, we're actually trying to help facilitate the connection between funders and local entrepreneurs in a way that, like I said, very much builds off of the good work done by the Boston Fed. So all four of those things are places we're very excited about.
Thanks. I think we have a little bit of time for questions from the floor, and I may not be able to see all of you, so Angelique, you can help me call on folks.
And we've got mics in back.
Thanks for convening this. David Lipsitz, Housing Assistance Council. What can you do as bank presidents right now with your CRA enforcement responsibilities to stop CRA from aggregating affordable capital in suburban and urban places to the detriment of rural places? The Fed was phenomenal in the 2023 negotiations for the rules, so maybe you can just say some of the things you had there. But if two bankers go into their credit committee and they ask for affordable capital from their bank for a housing development, the one next to a bank branch will get that loan every time. Nobody in a room full of community development folks who care deeply dislikes CRA for doing that, but clearly we need in rural places a
way to get that affordable capital away from the bank branch to the communities that we serve.
So maybe I'll take that one on behalf of the Federal Reserve System. You know, I think with respect to the 2023 rule, we made enormous progress in integrating the needs, the challenges, the experiences of rural America. And we understood, and the final rule reflected that we understood, that that capital is harder to get. And it requires more work on behalf of the bank. It sometimes can be more expensive to do. It's certainly more can be more complicated to do. And so the rule took that into account. You know, unfortunately, as you know, the banking sector, the trade groups for the banks, filed suit arguing that that rule was unlawful. And they won in the district court that they brought it in the Fifth Circuit. And we're now in a position where we needed to go back to the 1995 rule, just on the reality of the experience that we're in right now. But we still understand that we haven't forgotten that rural communities need more work and more help and more assistance. And so I do think there are ways for us within the existing framework to acknowledge that special kind of role. And I think it's an important area for us to work on.
Yeah, hi, Jim Barr from USDA Rural Development. And hopefully this is a little bit more of a softball question for you all. Maybe not.
That's good, then the presidents will take that
yeah.
one. Governor Barr take the tough
we
one.
All have our jobs.
Yeah. Right. So as I'm sure you're aware, Treasury just released all the eligible census tracts for Opportunity Zones, so kind of Opportunity Zones 2.0. I'm curious to get your thoughts. Obviously, there's going to be, I think the list is over 8,000 census tracts that will be that have been designated as rural opportunity zones, higher tax incentives. So I'd be curious to get any of your thoughts, because it didn't come up in our conversation. Mm-hmm. I have a lot that I took down, even though I belong to rural development, so thank you for that. But I didn't hear anything about opportunity zones, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity, excuse the pun, to discuss what opportunities as well as challenges might be to drive private investment through that tax incentive.
I should ask, I don't know, have any of you had experience in your communities with learning about opportunity zone projects?
More in the urban landscape than in the rural. I haven't mm-hmm. heard that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a good call out, and I'll ask some questions about it. But,
the
challenge I always had with them in the urban context was that when you've got 8,000 investment opportunities, the single best investment opportunity is the one sort of right next to the stadium. You know, it's just the economics that are so much better than the one that's in the least good part of town with no adjoining benefit. And so I'll be curious. What the any tax incentive is a good incentive if you want to get development going, but whether it tracks incremental capital, I'll just be interested in seeing what the dynamics are.
I think we have time for one more.
Chris Estes, North Carolina Rural Center. Thank you again for the convening. I want to laud you all for the work that you were describing of convening, listening, reflecting, and make one suggestion that what has happened in recent years is that we have done a lot more of connecting and understanding rural, but that conversation has been sort of separate from the conversations that people are having about urban. And so as folks who have big regional districts and, frankly, a different kind of pulpit to talk about the value of rural, to bring that to your non-rural audiences, the two words I think I use the most are interdependence and interconnectedness, because to talk about what's different about rural, what's working in rural, why it's that shifts the more traditional economic development folks who are generally not with the folks in this room on strategy, the business communities, the folks who think about the value tend to look at discussions about rural as, well, you're doing something that's going to create less value than if you did it with us. Mm. And there is this implied sense of competition from a scarcity framework. And you all are some of the few institutions that could have those conversations with audiences who are you know, whereas we're generally talking to our own rural brethren, so to speak, and when we're talking to our statewide chambers or other folks, that's sort of a nice thing, but there's a little pat on the head with that sometimes. Whereas when the Fed's talking about it, it has a different resonance of the value for the whole state, for the why should Philadelphia care? Why should Richmond or Charlotte care? Why should Boston care? So my two cents on that.
Yeah, that's a wonderful suggestion. Susan, do you want to just follow
up? So thank you for the comment. Let me just say a couple of things about that. One is that, it's hard to pick the many examples, but two of the examples that I picked were actually trying to help make those connections. So the one about the cancer genome, that was connecting the Jackson Labs, which is in Bar Harbor, and it's connecting cancer experts, most of whom are in urban centers, with rural communities. And so that connection is one of the things related to the healthcare that is really central. And then some of the work related to some of the engineering entrepreneurship, and that then becomes about transportation and the connectivity and how to make sure that you bring people together so that you can see win-win situations. The one other thing I'll say is that the initiative that I talked about that Tom mentioned started out as working cities. That's where it started, focusing on small cities and what we knew about resurgence of small cities. But then we actually did expand it out. So the name, it has like three or four different names. It was working cities and then working places and then working communities. But ultimately, 14 of the 30 were rural. And that means an opportunity to bring all of the networks across all of those sites, some of which were more urban-based, some of which were rural, together to talk about common challenges. So there were multiple groups that looked at housing issues, that looked at empowering youth, that looked, and so that's actually a cross-fertilization for some of those groups that are trying to be problem solvers. But I do think there's more work to do in that space, and appreciate the comment.
Yeah, I think that's a really useful comment to think about the broader ecosystem and the connections across places and how, you know, what lifts all boats kinds of things, right? And also just, you know, obviously products that are created in rural areas are sold other places, but there's workforce connections as well, right? So I've heard from, you know, rural manufacturers who are trying to find skilled laborers who go and recruit at urban high schools, right? You know, and they're taking buses out to, you know, come and see what this new cool factory floor looks like because, you know, this is, you know, where you could come and live and make a really good living. And then by the, I think on the other side, our rural areas tend to be on the leading edge of some of the demographic changes that we're going to be experiencing more broadly as a country. And so thinking about what we can learn from rural areas as we address, you know, an aging workforce or an aging economy generally, I think there's just a lot of cross-fertilization. And I hear what you're saying, too, about the, you know, the funding part. But thinking about how you link those things together seems really powerful.
Well, I wish we could talk for another hour, but you all have real work to do when we step away. Would you please join me in thanking our wonderful panel?